This episode is brought to you by Omsom, the new pantry staple brand bringing proud, loud Asian flavors into your kitchen. This week on Meat & Three, we continue our trade series with a piquant look at the many faces of the spice trade, from the high price tag of saffron to the ubiquity of chilies and the potential ripple effect that farmer protests in India may have on the global spice market.
You know, farmers are protesting because they feel like their lives and livelihoods are on the line.
You find it in a lot of cured foods, like cured meat and Parmesan cheese. You also find it in ripening foods, like ripe tomatoes are very high in MSG. So there's sources of it all over the natural world.
Tune in to Meat & Three, HRN's weekly food news roundup, wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello, welcome to Japan Eats. I'm your host, Akiko Tema, food writer and director of the New York Japanese Culinary Academy, which promotes a deep understanding of Japanese cuisine in America. This show is all about Japanese food and food culture. We see sushi at every deli in the supermarket, but what is beyond sushi? We hear dashi, ramen, izakaya, but what exactly are they? Japanese food is still a mystery for many people, and I try to demystify it in this program with my cool guests. My guest today is Ian Chun, who is the owner of Japanese online tea shop and community, Yunomi.life. The website is not just selling tea, but highly inspirational and educational about Japanese tea and underlying unique Japanese culture. For example, you can meet tea producers on the designated webpage to understand each producer's detailed history, tea fields, and manufacturing philosophy with images and videos. So today we'll discuss how Ian got into Japanese tea, his philosophy of connecting people through tea, unique health benefits of Japanese tea, how to enjoy Japanese tea at home, and much, much more. But before you start, Japanese is available on the Heritage Radio Network website as well as on iTunes, Stitcher, and Spotify as a podcast. So please go to iTunes, Stitcher, and Spotify, whichever you listen to, and subscribe to Japanese. And please write a review. We really appreciate your feedback. Now let's start a conversation with Ian Chun. Hello, Ian. Welcome to the show.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
Thank you for having coming joining us, and it's 4 o'clock in the morning in Japan, 5 o'clock. So
5 o'clock.
Yeah. Thank you so much for your early day. I'm sure you're going to have a great day today. So first of all, where are you from and what did you eat when you grew up?
I am from Hawaii. I was born and raised in Hawaii. My parents were, my father's side, I'm third generation Chinese, and my mother is from Taiwan. And because my mother is in Taiwan, obviously I grew up eating a lot of Chinese food, but I also grew up eating a lot of Japanese food. And of course, because I grew up in Hawaii, I was surrounded by a lot of Japanese food. So I ate a lot of musubi going to school in the mornings. I remember my mom made the very greatest ebi fry, fried shrimp, Japanese style fried shrimp. At New Year's, we had a family tradition to have. My mom called it shabu shabu, but it's really more like a nabe. For New Year's, for some reason, we always eat that for New Year's. So my fondest memories growing up was of eating a lot of Japanese food growing up.
Nice. So it's funny that you said, ebi fry, Japanese shrimp fry. It's unique. It's like a more fine panko. And then there is a test. If you're a patient person and there is ebi fry in the bento box, if you can save it until the end, you're very patient. And if you eat it first, you're very impatient. That's a kind of patience test. I don't know which one you are.
Yeah, it goes very quickly.
Okay. So you went to Brown University, and once you decided to become an astronomer, But how did you get into the tea business?
It's a very long, it was a 10-year path between Brown University and a tea business. Like you said, I went to Brown University because they had a very, they're a famous school and they're a very good school, and they had a very good astronomy program. I wanted to be an astronomer at that time when I was 18 years old. I ended up the summer after my first year of college, I ended up at the Institute of Astronomy at University of Hawaii as a research assistant. And I helped an astronomer build a photograph of a star cluster using the data that he had gotten from radio telescope. And it was the most boring thing I have ever done in my entire life. It was very interesting in terms of the science, but to process the data was very lonely and very boring. And I ended up I started to read some novels by Kawabata Yasunari. He's the Nobel Prize winning novelist from Japan, right? And I decided that I was going to switch my major at college from physics to literature, which nobody in my family was very happy with. But that was my initial introduction to, conscious introduction to Japan and what made me want to start learning Japanese. And eventually I came to Japan for the first time as a student in my third year of college. And I just, I fell in love with... So when my first year of college, I actually went moving from Hawaii to Rhode Island on the East Coast. I lost about 15 pounds. The cafeteria there was all you can eat on one hand, but I didn't really enjoy the food that was made at the cafeteria. And then, so when I came to Japan, the food was just amazing here.
Right.
And so it was kind of like coming, in a way, it was kind of, it felt like coming home. And so after college, I came back to Japan and I did the JET program. I taught English. Then I landed a job at a magazine company that produced surfing magazines and Hawaii travel magazines. Then I continued my literature degree and got a master's of literature at Sophia University. A master's in Asian studies, I should say. They didn't have a master's for literature. But I studied with... contemporary Japanese literature in college as well, but at Sophia University, my research focus was on rooftops and the motif of rooftops in Japanese literature and society, and that kind of led me to the use of rooftops in commercials. And I started. This was about the time when the iPhone was coming out, and I started to realize how influential business can have on the activities of business can have on culture and society. iPhone was changing the way we were doing everything, basically, right? And then I looked at the way rooftops were being used in commercials, and in Japanese culture, the history of rooftops. Rooftops meaning like a flat okujo in Japanese, which is a flat area that somebody can go on top of, versus a yane or yane no ue, which is a slanted roof that you're not supposed to go on top of. Like, so a space above a building that you can go onto as an okujo, it has a history in Japan that has changed and the meaning of it has changed with time. In the modern era, rooftops are a space where you can go to kind of escape society, and it has that kind of meaning. And it had that meaning for like beer commercials and ramen commercials, where you wanted to just get away from the stress of life. So I started studying that, and that kind of led me to a job in, I ended up with a job as a web editor at an IT company, editing their website, which I ended up joining the company and getting into marketing, and found that I was fairly good at being part of corporate America. However, you know, I didn't come from a business background, and then I got married, and my wife wanted to do an MBA. She ended up going to Cornell, so I ended up following her. And so we placed her career first. And at that time, I had met a Japanese tea farmer from Kyoto. During my previous job at that company, I ended up helping the company set up e-commerce websites throughout Asia Pacific. So I ended up helping this tea farmer from Kyoto set up a website to sell his tea in English, and that's how I really first got started in the tea industry. And the company name is called Matcha Latte Media, and I had gotten that idea because I liked matcha latte, for one thing, but I thought that it was a very interesting metaphor for the combination of something Japanese and something Western. And I thought that could be a very interesting name for a company. I didn't think at that time how badly the acronym would sound. But I decided that it was, by that time I had set up the company. And so I set up the company as a kind of a web consultancy, to help people build websites to access foreign markets in English, and not merely just promote them, but be able to actually generate business for them. And I got very interested in helping tea farmers, or farmers in general, but tea farmers specifically, because of the lifestyle they led, and because of the situation that I had discovered through this tea farmer from Kyoto, and the fact that tea farming, or farming in general, had several long-term problems that faced the agricultural community, and so that was my how I got into the tea business. It was through the fact that I had just happened to meet a tea farmer who needed some help, but it was I found tea to be very extremely fascinating as a kind of academically. I found it to be very fascinating, and I had loved tea from before. But in terms of business, it was because of that farmer, Yasuharu Matsumoto, from Kyoto Obubu Tea Farms. He was very charismatic guy. The first time he showed me what's called a kabusecha, shaded tea, I don't know if I should say this, but he jumped up on top of the table to say, "Wow, this is great." I was like, "Whoa!" He jumped up on top of the table.
That's so, like a taboo in Japan, but he did it. So excited.
that's not something you do in Japan, Definitely.
Right. Certainly. Yeah, he was in a euphoric moment.
So it's a long story, coming from Hawaii to the tea business. But I think everything that led up to that, everything in the story is part of the journey and leads you to where you are.
Right. You've turned many corners, and then it seems like, I don't know the synchronicity, but I think it makes sense that I'm so glad that you're doing what I'm doing right now. By the way, so you just mentioned, how the tea industry in Japan is declining, So 3 decades ago, there are about over 200,000 tea farms. And as of 5 years ago, there are only 20,000. So it's only 10% remaining. And the farmers are getting older, average age over 60 years old. And of course, like any other traditional industry, younger generations tend to stay away from hardworking farming business. So it's hard. So
it is. And it's interesting when you, there's a new, you know, social media app called Clubhouse. And I'm on there and I'm listening to young farmers on there talk about how, you know, they never seem to be happy. I mean, they're happy, but they don't have a very good, they have a very pessimistic outlook on farming and the tea industry, if for tea industry specific farmers. Yeah, it's very sad to hear that how pessimistic they are about their own industry.
Right. I think that reminds me of, you know, the Japanese sake industry. Now it's really booming outside Japan, which motivates a lot of sake producers. And they are inventing a lot of products towards more foreign market. It's like very creative. But yeah, I think the image of traditional industry stays dark and, you know, it's like declining. But who knows, maybe you're creating that platform to market Japanese tea outside Japan and that's stimulating the whole industry. I hope it's going to happen.
I believe so. I don't think we are specifically having an impact on the industry yet at our size. I think that we have done some work. I don't know if it's, you know, well, I don't know if we are the ones influencing, but I think we have our stance towards transparency and teaching people about the people who are behind the products that they are consuming. I think that has spread through the Western industries. And tea itself is, the exports for tea is increasing, has increased over the last 10 years quite dramatically. But it's still only like a drop in the bucket for the Japanese tea industry in general. I guess it's one of two things that are increasing positively in the tea industry right now. The other being the growth of the matcha industry domestically and abroad. But primarily, as popular as matcha and Japanese tea are getting in the U.S. and in Europe and elsewhere. I can see my clients in Thailand, for example, are doing very well, and they're getting a lot of competitors as well. And more people in Thailand are drinking matcha. But the majority of the tea industry still is in Japan, 95% or 94% maybe now because of the decrease in production. But it's still, the majority of it is still domestic, and that domestic industry is not doing so well.
When I first saw your website, I was excited because it's a, you know, tea is a lifestyle, in my opinion, and your website really depicts what it is, because, you know, it's a packaged product at the end of the day, but it's like, you know, if you go to Japan, if you go to somebody's house, there's a tea always served, and it's not something to consume, it's part of your life.
That's actually kind of part of the problem, actually, in Japan, at least. The culture of tea, and I think, you know, the culture of tea is one of the primary reasons why I love doing this business. But the culture of tea in Japan is part of the omotenashi, for the hospitality that you serve as a host to your guest, right? And because of that, tea is always free. And that is part of the problem for the industry, I think.
Interesting.
It's not, you know, you walk around Japan and this past weekend, we went to a restaurant that serves unagi, really high quality unagi, and we received Japanese tea, green tea, in the beginning as you know, for free. And it was definitely not on the menu. Coffee was on the menu, black tea was on the menu, oolong tea was on the menu, but not green tea. You know, it was not something that you could order. It was something that was free in the restaurant. And because it was free, reveals something about the quality of the restaurant, but that restaurant was serving pretty low grade green tea, unfortunately. Right.
Interesting. So, what I heard in this country a long time ago, Japanese restaurants served free sake, which was cheap for free, and you get a headache. That was really a bad start of the introduction. And also, I don't know, maybe 10 years ago, in New York, restaurants started to charge bread. And the first time, people said, what? It has to be free. Why do you charge money for bread? It comes with food. But then I think people's perception changed. They're willing to pay for very special bread rather than being discarded because nobody actually touches it, that kind of thing. So I think that perception can change. But I think the other thing is...
I'd be very interested to know how that has changed for bread and for other products.
Yeah, I think because now it's becoming the focus of attention, media started to feature, this bread is really good and this how it's made and this kind of video how it's made or the ingredients and how sustainable. All this marketing, it's not just marketing to create some fat, it's about reporting how actually important to show one piece of bread can have a lot of efforts and quality. And that's the thing people want to feel and find. And by effectively, you can save food waste too. So that's how I think it happened. But that additional perceived value in terms of tea, I think what you're doing amazing is that on your website, you say your business is based on the idea of people to people, more than just farm to table. So could you elaborate on that?
Well, you know, I started the business not because I liked tea. And so that's probably the main reason why I ended up with this philosophy. I started the business because I love the people in the business. I met one tea farmer who introduced me to other tea farmers, and I helped many different tea farmers launch their websites in English. I discovered that it was it made more sense to aggregate them into one location instead of market their websites separately. And therefore, that's how I got started with the launching Unomi.life after I launched the business. And so because I was very interested in Japanese, the tea farmers in Japan and the farming community in Japan, I wanted customers to really know the fact that this tea is not just good, but it comes from, you know, this person who has done so much work to make it for them. And so, you know, it's very basically the same thing. It comes from the farm and goes to your table, yes, but you know, it's in a way the commerce of the activity of the commerce, the transaction between the farmer to the consumer is a form of communication. And you hear that in other you know, people who are doing marketing, you hear that, you know, it's, you know, we want this, we want our consumers to, you know, experience this when they taste our product, right? I think that's a form of communication to me. And therefore, tea is representative of the fact that the emotions, the intentions, and the will of the producer is transferred to the person who is consuming it when they are able to taste the product. And so that's that really underscores the business and what we're doing and everything we try to do, the things we don't try to do, and this idea of people to people.
Right.
So,
yeah, it's interesting. Like in New York City, there are many farmers market, like especially if you go to like Union Square Farmers Market, we know that farmers wants to talk about their products. But when it comes to tea producers, they don't have that access to direct communication with who's using it. And whatever I interview, like sake producers or anything, anybody who's doing something traditional, they have so much to share. And I'm so glad that you are doing what I want to do on your website, because the information is so plenty, abundant, and some of them are videos, and it's really fun. So
yeah, it's still not ideal. It's not, you know, it's not a two-way communication between, and that's something I've struggled with, and like I would like to find a way to recreate that farmer's market experience online across languages. And that's the main thing. Like, it's across languages, right? And if we could find a way to do that, and I have lots of ideas about how you could do that. Not many of them not very practical, but you know, like if you could click a button and have a video call from the website to the farmer, that would be, and the farmer would pop up on a live video chat for, you could chat with them. That would be great, except that, you know, there's a time difference and a language barrier.
Right. But maybe, you know, it sounds pretty realistic to me, except for a time difference. You know, we're managing, you know, you are 14 hours ahead of me, but we are talking.
But then, you know, the other thing is that farmers are not always their own best salesmen.
Yeah.
Right. Sometimes they can, you know, so they're not salesmen, they're farmers, right. They're producers.
Right. Well,
that's one of the other problems.
Right. But that's what we want to know, right? Like refreshing. We don't want to be sold. We want to buy it because I like this person, that kind of mindset. So, but you have over 125 small producers, and
we actually have like 170 now.
Oh my god! You have to update the number on the homepage.
I have to update the website. Yeah.
Okay, so basically, we're gonna talk more about the producers, actual producers on your clients. But so first, let me ask you about what is the difference between Japanese tea and other types of tea, such as Chinese tea?
So very basically, the vast majority of the tea in Japan is sencha, and sencha is a green tea made by steaming the leaf after you've harvested it. You steam the leaf, then you roll it, and you dry it as you roll, and then you. Then after it dries, you dry it a little bit more, and then you refine it by removing the stems of the leaves. And this process makes it into a kind of needle-like shape. And this defines the vast majority of the tea produced in Japan. And there are variations. Chinese green tea actually makes up most of the green tea that is on the market around the world, except for Japan. And Chinese green tea is primarily made by, instead of steaming, you would fire it in a pan, not exactly roast it, but you would heat it, but directly against a metal surface. And that is what stops the oxidization process in the leaf. And so it creates two different types of green teas. Pan firing also occurs, is also made in Japan, but it's much a smaller percentage of the production. And so Japanese green tea is primarily, you know, you could think of it as primarily as a steamed green tea. That allows it to retain a lot of the nutrients in the leaf that was originally there in the leaf.
And not to mention that beautiful green color.
And the beautiful green color, yes.
Okay, so and what are the benefits of drinking Japanese tea?
I generally don't promote tea for health benefits because I think it gets well, besides, you know, the legalities of promoting tea for the health benefits, there's a lot of I think that there's a lot of evidence that shows that green tea can be potentially healthy for people in different ways. Everybody is different. Every person's body is different, and their diet is different. And I think that my belief and what I think about when I talk about the life steeped in tea, or in Japanese I say ocha no jinsei, I think that tea is part of a lifestyle that is healthy. And that lifestyle, including, you know, the diet that you, the things that you eat, and primarily Japanese cuisine because it's Japanese tea, but that lifestyle is essential. The lifestyle in its entirety is essential to leading a healthy life, and that's my philosophy for drinking. Approaching tea for its health benefits. I think the benefits of drinking tea are more in terms of mindfulness. When you drink tea in the way that it has traditionally been drunk in Japan, in terms of the tea ceremony on one hand, but in more casually in terms of what you do, the social activity of drinking tea in your home with your family or with friends who visit. And that activity itself is part of the benefits of tea and a lifestyle in which tea takes a central part.
Right. Wow. What an excellent answer. Mindfulness, and it's really true. Like any occasion, you have a break, there's tea. Like come home, you want to just take a break, and then come down, you have tea. And for gathering and after dinner, it's just always something. You just draw the line between activities, which is, I think, it's really important. It's not always.
And you know, if somebody is really into tea and, you know, an aspiring connoisseur, and I think our website leans towards those people who are aspiring connoisseurs, it is very meditative to taste tea in the way that you taste wine, or you taste sake, or you taste whiskey. You're tasting for the subtleties and differences and flavors, and when it comes to tea, that becomes very meditative for many people, and I think that meditative process is, you know, part of this idea of leading a balanced life.
Right. Okay. And so there's another element of tea. So in the US, for example, people really don't have the habit of drinking tea like Japanese people do, and we tend to rely on tea bags. But what is the what's the kind of advantage? Why should we drink leaf tea instead of tea bags for convenience?
Primarily, tea bags are meant to be something that is cheaper. It's actually, interestingly, it's not cheaper because of the extra material that's used for the tea bag, as well as the cost of, you know, packing the tea and the leaf into the tea bag. What happens is that you get very low quality leaf in general. You get very low quality leaf in the tea bags, and you get a small amount. And so it's meant to be used, not to be used in an efficient manner. Efficient in terms of time, but not really efficient in terms of getting the most flavor as well as the most quantity out of the leaf. Traditionally, when you use loose leaf tea, the tea leaves are whole leaves or larger leaves and of higher quality. And so you get a better flavor out of it, and you would steep the tea several times. And this goes for not just Japanese tea, but all tea in general. You could steep it several times, so you would get much more out of the leaf than a single tea bag by itself. But the primary thing is that it is, and there are people who use high quality leaves and pack them into tea bags, so that you can have the convenience with high quality tea, but it's still very rare. And so the better flavor does come with loose leaf teas, as well as the more variety of tea types themselves are available when you look at non-tea bag tea products.
Right. I've seen a video of a processing factory of tea, and then after the machine is done to process leaf tea, the powder is left, and that's going to be going to tea bags. So it's maybe the high quality, but it's just the, you know, powders, leftover powders. But it's better than not drinking tea, I guess, but that's the fact. And then, like you said, the price is not cheaper just because it's powder. But right, so, well, listeners, it's worth buying leaf tea, and I'm going to talk about this, ask the question later, but, you know, like, you have a nice teapot, teacup, and there's a ritual, like making a nice cup of coffee. It's the same thing, and you grind coffee beans, you smell better, it's the same thing, you have better appreciation of tea leaves. So I'm for leaf tea and the tea bags.
There are famous tea producing regions in Japan. So for listeners who are not familiar with those differences, could you tell us the regions that you would probably find once you shopping tea bag?
The main production regions in Japan are Shizuoka is the largest region. Kagoshima is the second largest region. And then not Kyoto specifically, but the Kyoto region, including Nara, Mie, Shiga, and Kyoto. That region also is the third major production region in Japan. And each region is, it has its own qualities in terms of for example, the soil that is available there, and the terrain of the region also makes a big difference. In one of the primary examples is the fact that much of the region in Kagoshima is flat land, and therefore it being flat, it allows for much more efficient tea production. Because the Kagoshima region is a newer region when it comes to tea production, much of their equipment there is made for larger scale production that's more efficient. So they are able to produce tea that is of decent quality but lower priced. And so they have been rapidly, well, they've been increasing their production quantity quite a lot. And they are also, in terms of seasons, the leaf starts coming out in the springtime much earlier in the south, and becomes later as you go north. And so you have those types of differences between the regions, but you also have differences in terms of production and what type of tea is mainly produced in those regions. And so you have Shizuoka that produces much more tea leaf that has been steamed for a very long time, and that's called Fukamushicha. And that long steaming produces a leaf that is a little bit more sweet than it would otherwise be. And it produces the leaves break up much more when you steep it, and therefore it produces a very opaque green color and deep green color. Kagoshima also produces a lot of Fukumushicha, but they also do a lot of shading on their leaf. And shading the leaf, even for a couple of days, will help the leaf become more sweet, and with a sense of umami taste to it. And then you have other regions that specialize, for example, in Kyoto and Fukuoka, some of the best gyokuro comes out of those regions, when gyokuro is a heavily shaded leaf. And Kyoto, of course, is very well known for its production of matcha. So different types of teas are produced everywhere on one hand, but some regions are more well known for producing certain types of teas.
Right. So basically,
and, the producers have more experience in those regions.
Right. And of course, around Kyoto area, there are many tea farms because it used to be a capital of emperors and rich people. So that's the history. But I think just like wine have different regions and terroir, tea is exactly the same thing and affected by the water, a river, everything, the minerals, and also, like you said, how geographically it's situated, right? So, well, it must be maybe you can have a tea tour, once COVID is gone, you can organize a tea farm visiting tour. I would love that.
The tea industry in Japan has become much more conscious of the fact that people want to visit the tea production regions. I think in Shizuoka, they built a new two companies and the Kawane region tea agricultural cooperative jointly built a matcha factory to produce matcha from start to finish all in one place. And it's a beautiful, beautiful, beautiful factory that unfortunately nobody gets to go to because they launched it last year. But you would never, until recently, you would never think to spend money on a nice design for the factory because it was just a factory.
Right.
But this factory is built so that people could visit and be impressed by the factory. So there's more conscious, people are more conscious here of the fact that people are, interested in tea tourism. The company that originally, got me into the tea industry is very well known in Kyoto for their tea tourism activities. They've brought in hundreds of tea interns, students from abroad to visit the region of Wazuka in Kyoto to learn about tea. And so they're very famous for doing that.
Wow. By the way, how do you select the tea producers that you work with?
So primarily I don't go to a region to find producers to work with. I do go to trade shows to find producers to work with, and then, before I would visit them afterwards. But I do take, when I meet them, I do look for a It's hard to quantify, and this is a problem for me going forward in terms of how do you set a specific criteria, how do you so that your employees can also choose producers, select producers accurately. But there is a sense of passion that people give off, producers especially give off, when they are extremely passionate about their product and dedicated to it. And that's the criteria that I use to choose them. And as a result of their passion for their product, they're farmers on one hand, but tea is a processed food product. So, you don't eat tea leaf that is raw. You don't, like you would for cabbage, for example. And the farmers who are also processing their own tea leaf, they have their own factory and they're processing it themselves. They are craftsmen. And so there's a sense of craftsmanship in their leaf and the passion that goes into it as a result. And so, whenever, no matter what level of quality of the leaf is, you can always be sure that the leaf is, the tea product is of high quality. That, on the website, it's a bit of a problem because then everybody's, puts a very high rating on the teas and the rating itself becomes very meaningless. But the passion that they have for their product really shows through when you meet them or when you talk to them on the phone, or and more recently, a lot of the farmers, especially the younger farmers, are on Instagram. So you can see what they post about. And so that passion shows through, I think.
That's fascinating. All right, so we'll take a quick break here. And when we come back, Ian will give us tips to enjoy Japanese tea at home. So please stay with us.
This episode is brought to you by Omsom, the new pantry staple brand bringing proud, loud Asian flavors into your kitchen. Omsom partners with iconic Asian chefs to craft rip-and-pour starters that pack all the specialty sauces, aromatics, and seasonings needed to cook restaurant-quality Asian dishes in under 30 minutes. No more diluted dishes, no more cultural compromise. Just bold Asian flavors sitting in your pantry right between the tomato sauce and olive oil. Learn more at omsom.com. That's omsom.com.
Welcome back. You're listening to Japan Needs. I'm your host, Akiko Katayama, and my guest today is Ian Jun, who is the owner of a fantastic Japanese online tea shop and community, Yunomi.life. So, who are your patrons? Who is drinking Japanese tea outside Japan, and if you know why?
I would say my patrons are aspiring or connoisseurs, aspiring connoisseurs and connoisseurs of Japanese tea. And the reason why is because we have, and this is something that we need to work on, but we have nearly 1,000 teas and tea products listed on the website right now. So it's, and for somebody who is just getting started, it's quite overwhelming. Much too overwhelming for somebody who doesn't know anything about Japanese tea. And so the people who come to us to buy tea, they're buying, they're searching through the website and spending much of their time looking through the website to figure out what they want to buy. And they'll end up buying several different products in every order in order to try different types of tea products from different regions. And so they're interested in tea. They're interested in learning more about tea. And they tend to be Because our website until very recently was in U.S. dollars, most of the customers are coming from America right now. And actually, I've done some mapping of where my customers are based. And it's very interesting that you can see that they are very often, they're concentrated in, you know, population centers like New York, San Francisco, and Los Angeles. But they also tend to be outside of the main areas. They don't have ready access to high quality Japanese tea in their immediate area. And I guess that leads them to search online for high quality tea.
Mm. Wow, that's excellent, because now everybody can buy high quality, super high quality tea, regardless of where you are, not just American country, like suburbs, or it could be any country.
We've had customers from Tasmania and Majorette, I think. I'm not sure if that's how you pronounce the name of the island, but an island, French territory between Madagascar and Africa. We have a customer there and a customer in the middle of Siberia, the Siberian region in Russia. And so we get customers from all over the place in the world, and we try to do our best to ensure that we can ship to all customers around the world. That has been a little bit more difficult in 2020 because of the chaos that the pandemic has caused. So some customers we can't serve, the ones in Russia, for example. It becomes much harder, but we try to, you know, we're not trying. On one hand, it's more efficient as a business to concentrate on one specific market, but we, you know, by our philosophy, we want to be able to get good tea to everybody who wants it.
Right. Well, I'm sure your producers, tea producers, must be really thrilled to hear, like, wow, it's drunk in the middle of this country, that country, and an island. So, all right. So, so now we know that Japanese tea is delicious and profound and very healthy, I think. So could you give us some tips to enjoy Japanese tea, maybe at home and on a daily basis? So, like you said, it could be a little overwhelming. So what tea shall we start with, and what do we need to drink tea at home?
So I do recommend getting a teapot of some type. And if you can even use something like a French press. And to use loose leaf tea instead of tea bags, although tea bags, you know, can be good if you have good tea inside the tea bag. But primarily, the main thing, especially for Japanese green tea, the primary things to pay attention to are the temperature of the water and the time that you're spending to steep it. Black tea, generally you steep it for 3 to 5 minutes, but for Japanese green teas, primarily you steep it for, you know, 30 to 60 seconds. And that time frame is important in making the tea just light, strong enough that it's enjoyable, but not too strong. And the temperature of the water plays a very big, is a very important factor in getting certain types of flavor out of the leaf. The amino acid theanine, which is a more savory flavor, is extracted at a lower temperature of about, what is it in Fahrenheit? About 140 degrees Fahrenheit, or 60 degrees Celsius. And as you increase the temperature, the antioxidants, which are very bitter tasting, as well as the caffeine, is extracted at higher temperatures. So the higher the temperature is, the more bitter the tea gets. And this applies across the board, with all different levels and grades of tea. So no matter what grade of tea that you might have, you know, if you want a sweeter taste, you should use a lower temperature. You can even steep it in cold water, which takes longer if you're the lower the temperature is, the longer it takes to extract flavor out of it. So you might leave it for, put it into cold water and leave it in your refrigerator for 3 to 4 hours, and you would have a very sweet iced tea at that when you do that. So the main things is temperature and time, and pay attention to those, and then you'll be able to have very, very good tea. That being said, I know that it's very interesting. There's a generational gap in Japan, at least, and people who tend to be older like very, very bitter tea. And I have some suppliers who make absolutely amazing tea, but they'll, you know, steep it at boiling water, which makes it very, very bitter. And they're like, this is what tastes great. So it's very interesting.
Wow. Interesting. So over time, people gain a palate for bitterness, maybe?
Maybe.
Or I'm not quite they grew sure. up with bitterness. But, well, but
they might have grown up tasting that. And right. That's what they like. Yeah.
Right.
But bitterness is on the other hand, bitterness is an indication of the amount of antioxidants in the leaf, in the tea.
Good to know. So, right. Oh,
right.
So as for the temperature, I am lazy, so I don't use measuring, you know, temperature, like gadgets or anything. So how many, like once the pot is boiled, how many minutes shall I leave? Like 5 minutes or to get to the temperature around 140 degrees?
You know, actually I've never thought about leaving the hot water to cool down. When you pour hot water into a container, like a ceramic container that is cold, generally, in general, and it depends on the temperature of your room, but in general, the temperature of the boiling water will decrease by 15 to 20 degrees as it warms up, as the heat is transferred to the ceramic container. So in traditional way of steeping tea, you would pour it into you would pour hot water into your empty teapot. That reduces it by about, you know, 15 to 20 degrees Fahrenheit or 10 degrees Celsius. And then you would pour it into your cup, and then it reduces the temperature more. And so by that time, the temperature of the water itself will decrease to 70 to 80 degrees Celsius, or what is that in Fahrenheit?
Oh, wow. So you don't have to...
Yeah, so you don't wait. You use your containers to your teapot and your teacups to change the temperature,
nice.
Lower it. And then if you want to lower it even more, you can use like what's called a yuzanashi. It's another container that allows you to, you know, make the water cooler, which is what yuzanashi stands for.
Right. Or you can just use a big bowl, ceramic bowl, to cool it down.
You can just use a big bowl, yeah.
Right. Yeah, right. Wow. And then not to mention, there's so many beautiful pots and cups to play with. So,
Yes.
It's really fun to choose those things from. So, yeah. Let's drink tea at home because it's so fun and you get mindful.
It's, you know, you have to wait for your tea. So, and if you observe your tea leaves unfurl or open up, then that it's a form of meditation, I think.
I have a teapot that's made of a glass, so I can see actually the color changes, and it's really, actually really meditative. So that's my favorite moment. Right. Okay, so we are kind of running out of time. So what are your plans?
So this year, I'm very focused on not the front end, but the back end of the business. So like I said, we're moving into a professional warehouse. The storage of tea long-term should be done in a cool environment, like a refrigerated environment. So the partner that our warehouse partner has a refrigerated warehouse. So we're going to move our inventory into that location. And I'm going to move the office into a location in Tokyo. And what we're trying to do is set up a system that allows us to recruit many different, many more tea farms, tea producers, as well as we're thinking about getting into other types of food products such as kombu and wakame, and if possible, and this is presents a logistics challenge, but you know, shoyu and miso and dashi, and so we would like to get into like providing very high quality artisanal Japanese foodstuffs that allows you to make Japanese food at home, as well as be able to. And the hard part of exporting is that there's a lot of regulations surrounding different types of, and different regulations that are surrounding different types of food. So we'd like to be able to build a platform that can easily aggregate that information from suppliers as well as from government industry into one database, that we can then easily say, okay, this tea or this, you know, this product is able to be shipped to this country, but not this country. Or if we need to ship it to this country, then we need these types of documentation for that, for the customs processing in that country.
Right. Excellent.
So that's the, you know, how the company is starting to look like now in terms of being the complexity of international food export is very, it's a minefield.
Right, because the small producers cannot afford it. They're busy manufacturing. So a lot of them need your help. Yeah. So good luck.
Exactly. Thank you.
Yeah, so where can we find your updates online and social media?
You can find me at the website at younomi.life. You can find me on Instagram at younomitea or Twitter at younomitea. I am on Pinterest, but the Pinterest account is kind of dormant right now. And I am on Clubhouse at Ian Chun. And so if anybody is on Clubhouse, please come and find me to talk about tea.
Sounds great. All right. So thank you so much for joining us today, Ian. And well, thanks again for getting up so early in the morning.
Thank you. Thank you very much for the time.
So listeners, if you have any questions or comments about the show or suggestions for show topics or guests, please contact us at japanneeds@theheritageradionetwork.org or at kikokatema.com. Japan Needs is a weekly program and always available at heritageradionetwork.org as well as on iTunes, Stitcher, and Spotify as a podcast. Our engineer is Aman Wang, and thank you for listening. I will see you next week. Japan Needs is powered by Simplecast. Thank you for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For freshest content, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Instagram and Twitter at heritage_radio. You can also find us at facebook.com/heritageradionetwork. Heritage Radio Network is a non-profit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Subscribe to the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join the HRN family by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thank you for listening.